From UCB Comedy Studios, this is the UCB Digital Podcast. I'm Nate Russell. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the show. Well, let's go on the record right now and say we were wrong last week.
Very wrong.
Hey, Ben. Hi. Ben Hosley's here, too. Ben, we were both wrong.
Yes.
We both made maybe an ill-timed prediction that the writers were going to go on strike. We didn't release the episode until after news had broken that they hadn't gone on strike. So we were wrong, everybody. We were wrong. And congratulations to everybody for in the WGA and in the whole system for there still being work this week. That's the big winner is everybody. So it's really great that that didn't happen.
And what's great, too, is that, you know, the health care bill passed in our government, too.
Yeah. So you get the good, you get the bad, you know. That's true. That's true. I read a quote just talking about the strike, and we'll move on from it because now it's old news. But an interesting quote that I saw was one of the executives, this is from, I think, an LA Times article, said it wasn't the studios who did this to the writers. It was just the world that was that has changed. And they actually said we were very sympathetic to the writers and all of their issues. And it's interesting to sort of see that quote because it is nice that there's an acknowledgement here. I think that, like, maybe 10 years ago, the studios were not necessarily as sympathetic to the idea that there'd been such a ground, you know, a shift, right? Mm-hmm. They were sort of like holding on to the old structure for dear life, saying, no, 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 don't anybody change anything. And I think that part of what made this deal possible was recognition on both sides that, like, no, this digital shit has disrupted the marketplace and the whole way that everybody, you know, that our society consumes media. So we need to catch up with that in our agreements.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's, you know, immeasurable, I think, at this point, because it's also happening so fast.
Sure. Sure. Which is also the other news that came out this week that affects comedy and digital content. And a lot of folks, including UCB, was news that sort of broke this week that CISO is having some changes. CISO, of course, NBC Universal's comedy streaming service that had been a big advocate for emerging comedy voices. Ben, you were saying that, you know, a lot of folks have had, like, opportunities through there, you know.
Yeah, a bunch of friends even just got to do one-off specials.
Yep.
It was just a lot of great talent,
yep,
up-and-coming people getting this opportunity to produce or write or be in a project that made it to, you know, this service.
And what a unique service it is. And the what the model was, you know, having original programming that was comedy centric, you know, and original. And of course, they were also big partners with UCB. You know, the UCB show ran on CISO for a couple of seasons, and we had the Andy Richter holiday special that played on there last Christmas.
Yep.
And the changes sort of like stemming from Evan Shapiro, who was running CISO and with CISO from the beginning, is really like the project that he was, you know, spearheading. He's moving on from that position, and it seems like there are more changes sort of afoot in their structure, and all the rumors say that it's relating to original content. Which is a bummer, but also, again, indicative of the fact that this stuff moves quickly. And, you know, this is a service that's, what, 2 or 3 years old?
Yeah.
And it's and as we've seen with several of these other, you know, discussions of, like, these other entities, especially here in New York, we talked about Seriously. We talked about, you know, even the changes at Above Average or we've been talking about the Flama a lot because I think about that because we had a few people from UCB who are full-time folks over there, and they just have totally shuttered.
I mean, even, you know, also this week, Chris Gethard's show.
Right.
Which had been living at Fusion.
Yep, yep.
Recently moved over to True TV. And it's exciting for that show, for sure, because they're going live. They're going to keep the hour.
Sure, that's great.
But, you know, also, I know from having worked on season one, Fusion was definitely, you know, still trying to keep afloat and find its footing.
And I think that, yeah, and I think that, like, essentially what it means is that the life cycle to find your footing is getting quicker, right?
Yeah.
And that's what it seems like some of these, you know, some of the lessons from these ventures is that, like, you got to be pretty sure about what you're putting together because you don't have that long of a time period before it, one, gets really expensive, and two, you know, it has the vulnerability to go away.
Yeah, it's like you go live and then, man, you do not have much time. There's no bumpers. There's no bumper lanes.
That's right. Absolutely. And that's also the nature of a for-profit media business, right?
Yeah.
Which dovetails nicely into today's episode because we're talking about the opposite.
Hey, great transition.
That was a great transition. Yeah, I'm getting better at those. Our guest today, and really excited to have this conversation because it's a wholly different world that he's participant in, but also really great perspective and really exciting things happening with him and with the organization. Our good buddy Sean Weiner stopped by to have a conversation with us about both his creative trajectory as a director. He's been a director on digital teams here at UCB for the last 3 years on one of my favorite teams, a team named Brinkman. They do dark cinematic web series content, and their new show is actually less web series and more like anthology short films. And in fact, Sean's latest film that he directed will be out on our Vimeo channel, vimeo.com/UCB comedy, this upcoming Thursday, the 11th of May. So check that out, will you? It's called The Second Mrs. Pell. It's part of a series called Trolls, which we talk about in this episode. And that showcases Sean's comedy directing side. But Sean also works on a day-to-day basis. He's a faculty member and a staff member at the Jacob Burns Film Center. And we go into the whole, if you're not familiar with Jacob Burns and you love cinema, especially if you're based here in New York, you should be familiar with them. They're great and a great arts organization. They're a nonprofit arts organization up in Westchester County in lovely Pleasantville, which I had the pleasure of going to the kickoff event of the program that Sean is running for them called Creative Culture. He's the director of the Creative Culture program, which is really an incubator program for emerging voices in cinema of all different types. They're focused on young voices and diverse voices and trying to empower filmmakers, especially those based in the Hudson Valley, but honestly, at this point, from anywhere, so long as they can come take advantage of the resources at Jacob Burns, but trying to put them in a position to be incubating films that they are really proud of and then trying to help those filmmakers grow in the independent film world. And as a nonprofit, Jacob Burns has the ability to do this in a way that their real goal is the success of the films and the filmmakers who they are incubating, because they aren't driven by a need to find a return on the product itself. It's not a traditional media company relationship. So it's really interesting to talk to Sean, who's done work both in the sort of for-profit media world and work with us at UCB, both as a branded content director for us and also a community member and somebody who does the sort of low, no-budget stuff the digital team program is, which is also a very collaborative filmmaking environment. So we talked to him about navigating those worlds and also the sort of like goals of the Creative Culture program and how that fits in with his sort of like track as a filmmaker, as a creative, and also as a creative producer, which is a new side of Sean that he's sort of seen emerge through the participation in this Creative Culture program specifically. So really excited to talk to him about all that stuff. It's all really an important conversation and a really cool perspective on, you know, we're sitting here, Ben, talking about the sort of like money side of things, and it's really fun to sort of be able to talk to somebody about the art side of things, to remember that this still is art at the end of the day, and we should have goals that go beyond just dollar signs if we're doing this medium the right way, right?
Yes, it is refreshing.
It's refreshing. It absolutely is. And really, you know what else is refreshing?
Oh,
a nice
man.
Bronx beer.
Jesus.
I'm telling you, I'm getting better at these. All right, Sean and I also sipped the rye beer from Bronx Brewery. The rye ale, it's a crisp golden orange pale ale with bold rye and piney hops. We sipped it while we chatted. As always, we are loving our partnership with the Bronx Brewery. Go to thebronxbrewery.com to check out all their craft beers. And have one the next time you're at the UCB East Bar because it's on draft. I'm going to go have one as we're recording this later tonight. Before my improv show over there. So I'm gonna put my money where my mouth is, or my mouth where my money is, or both ways, and have one of those beers later tonight. And thanks to Bronx for being the official house beer of the UCB Comedy Podcast Network. All right, let's jump into it. Our conversation with director, DP, editor, and creative producer, Sean Weiner. All right, Sean, I'm excited to talk to you because, and I was saying this to Ben before, I feel like you have a lot of different experiences within what I refer to as like socialist filmmaking, right?
Okay, yeah.
Which I always called the digital team sort of like a socialist filmmaking pod. That's the way I always thought of it.
Uh-huh.
Because there was no traditional hierarchy in the way that most productions are led by somebody creatively.
Mm-hmm.
It has a captain. mm-hmm. right? A boss, and there's a pay scale and a responsibility scale that goes along with it. Mm. But those teams were
unpaid.
Well, yes, unpaid.
So there was no pay scale.
You're right, absolutely.
So totally socialist.
But that also meant that there was nobody was leading it either. It was up to you as a group to steer together.
Mm-hmm.
And you were on a team that did that incredibly successfully for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And you've got an experience at Jacob Burns, which also feels like it's not necessarily socialist, but the nonprofit aspect of it means that you have a different set of goals, mm-hmm. right?
Sure.
And you have the experience from your private cabin collective, which also functioned in a similar sort of socialist, you know
sure.
or
yeah,
just collective mindset.
My
right?
father's way into being a socialist. It's all just goes back generations.
So I guess maybe start here. Why do you feel like you, what about you winds up in these type of environments? What do you get out of it? What do you like about it? How do you thrive in it? Because I think you do well in it.
Great question. That's interesting. I don't think I've ever thought about it that directly, which makes it a good question. I'm somebody who sort of found or grew up loving film, but didn't intend to make film, kind of found that late into undergrad as something that made sense for me. And so kind of got into it after a lot of people had already jumped into film school. And so I think I missed getting involved in this medium at a time where I was like, impressionable enough to let somebody say, like, this is how it goes, and me to just be like, got it, good, I'll do it that way. So by the time I got into it, I think I felt a little bit on the outside of that traditional hierarchy, that kind of like Hollywood, you know, looking at, you know, this is how it goes, this needs to make money, all of these kind of check boxes. And instead, I was kind of coming in at it from more of a collective sense.
Sure.
I think my sensibility was more following kind of small films. Collective-driven filmmaking was kind of big when I was getting into filmmaking, so mumblecore and things like that mm-hmm. were kind of big. And a lot of it was like, you know, there are as many actors in the film as there were crew members, and all told it was five people. You know, so it's like we're going to make this. And mm-hmm. And if we base it out of truth, and if we kind of really commit to it, and if we get to some weird places together on set, we're going to make something that resonates. And that's a good movie, even if it costs
sure
the price of a beer and a piece of pizza, you
right.
know. So I think in that way, like that idea of collective filmmaking like happened at the right time. And then also, you know, the technology had gotten to the point where you didn't need much to you know, you were seeing films kind of playing festivals, and they were made in that same way. So it was kind of like, what the hell, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that's just where it came from. And spent a lot of time at SUNY Purchase doing sketch comedy in terms of I had friends who did a lot of stage stuff, and I kind of came in and was like, oh, I'll be, you know, Terry Gilliam to your Monty Python. And that's how I learned how to make film in the first place.
Uh-huh.
And all of that stuff is a mess because it's just me learning throughout it.
Sure.
And at the other end of it, that same group of folks that I did sketch comedy with, of which all of them are now the We Hate Movies podcast guys. So they've sort of found another niche that they're working on.
Mm-hmm.
But all of us decided kind of one day to, instead of kind of taking on sketch directly, to try to take on something that was a little bit more dramatic, a little darker. And that's how Private Cabin came to be. And that's how our first feature came to be. So I think it's just fun to explore that kind of like deep, dark, true kind of content.
Yeah.
And the first feature we wound up making called We Are Strangers was initially a 1 weekend experiment where we showed up on a Saturday morning with a prompt, which was you get a knock on your door from somebody you haven't seen since high school, and you don't really want to see them again. And they're like, what's up, bro? What are we doing tonight?
Yeah.
And we all just described the person we would least want to see. We described the things that we were embarrassed about in high school, and we built a script out of that and then made the film in 24 hours. So there's something there. You know, you catch kind of fire when you're all doing it in a compressed time, and you also like put yourself in a really vulnerable state to kind of add ingredients to the story that are really universal because they're embarrassing. And if it's embarrassing to you, it's embarrassing to the audience.
Did that group, so Private Cabin was the sort of like collective, is it still an active collective?
Yeah, so we have a second feature that's going into festivals right now.
Great.
Yeah.
Awesome. And Did that come about as because also a lot of the folks from that collective are your sort of were your coworkers at Jacob Burns, right?
Yeah, well, one of them was Andrew Jupin, who's sort of the lead host on. Oh, I don't know if I can say that, but whatever. He's sort of he's definitely the guy who edits the episodes, so that gives him some leadership. On We Hate Movies, he's with me at the Burns. The other folks were peers at SUNY Purchase.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So they weren't necessarily from the Burns.
Yeah, yeah. Andrew and I just happened to go to the Burns afterwards.
Okay.
Yeah,
and that's just a coincidence.
A job opened up, and I was like, that guy's graduating college, you should hire that guy. And so, right. Yeah. But he was very qualified. I did nothing but point.
Right. I can dig it. So I guess I was just wondering, so that group sort of like forms, like sort of organically from people from film school and some people that are your sort of coworkers at the Burns.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you start making stuff together in that environment. You immediately jump into features, or are you doing stuff that's smaller before that?
Yeah, so, and to actually call out some other folks at the Burns, right, we meet our DPs, Justin Drabinski and Russell Prebord, at the Burns.
At the Burns.
Right, so that's not the original, I mean, it doesn't matter what our backstory is, but that's not the original group. But then you sort of, along the way, you pick up and find folks who are really talented at a thing that you weren't good at.
Sure.
So initially, when I'm shooting our sketch videos in Purchase, I'm shooting them, recording them, I'm doing everything, one-man band, and none of it's particularly good. You meet a really good DP, and you hold on to them for dear life. So we started by doing really short stuff, turning it around, and we actually spent a year, I can't remember exactly the year, putting out a sketch video every week for the calendar year. And we just said, like, why don't we just do this? This is a way that we can just put a lot out there. We can get significantly better at what we do.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're extremely short, like 30-second videos, and other times they were series that were coming out over the course of every week. And that was just a great kind of, like, baptism or whatever into, like, this thing, like just dunking ourselves in. And at the other end of it, you know, we wound up getting commissioned work from places like Cracked, and like we had put ourselves on the map to some extent, but ultimately I don't think any of us had thought about sketch as the end all. It's just kind of where we had started, and so that's how we sort of wound up. Once, if you put out a film or a video every single week for a calendar year, you get kind of sick of making sketch videos by the end of that year.
Sure.
I think that's how we wound up trying something a little bit more
ambitious.
Independent narrative sense. And then we made that short that I was just describing over that weekend where we had shared these personal stories. And on the ride, so we probably wrapped shooting that night at 5:30 in the morning. Justin drove me back to my apartment. It's like 6:30 in the morning. And as I leave the car, I was like, well, what if the main character, when he calls his girlfriend and she's at home, you know, visiting her parents at home, what if she's not actually at her parents' place? What if she's actually hanging out with her college friend? And that's how we figured out what our second act would be. And that's how it sort of became this experimental feature, which was three acts with three kind of vignettes, where we sort of created what was a 75-minute movie as opposed to just a short. So it was sort of an accidental feature in that way. But what was nice is that it was like kind of building off itself.
Okay, cool. So then it is really interesting to me then, because your experience as a creative and as a filmmaker in terms of in a collective environment has been in short form sketch, features, the stuff you did with Brinkman, like sort of like bridged somewhere between, you know, web some of it was a web series that was like a relatively scoped web series. And some of it was basically like making a low budget feature.
Yeah, and just dividing it into seven parts.
Yeah. And now you guys have even morphed into the new stuff, which is just independent short films that have sort of like an anthology type thread to them.
Right.
Right, which we'll get to in a little bit. But I guess what I'm wondering is, in terms of like that type of collective filmmaking, all of which is done on a shoestring and on passion and on scraping some stuff together and on calling in favors and in on, you know, the generosity of strangers and whatever you can pull together. How do you work inside of those groups in a way that keeps everybody engaged, happy, or are they, and yourself sort of like creatively challenged and engaged and moving things forward? Because that's a lot of different media, a lot of different types of content to make inside of what is ultimately a collective mindset,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
a socialist mindset.
Yeah, very socialist one. Yeah, one piece of it is this. I mean, if you self-identify as a director, let's say, and if at early on in your film career or whatever it is, you're like, I'm a director, you have to position yourself to be the director on sets. And likely you're not going to be paid to be a director the first day you say I'm a director because you have nothing to show for it. So part of the drive and the reason to keep doing this and to produce this much content was just saying, you know, well, fuck it. If I'm going to be a director, I have to direct stuff. And so I need to then produce the stuff I need to direct, and I need to do what I can to get a group of people excited about telling the stories that I want to tell. And the best way to do that is to make sure that there are also stories that those people want to tell. So that was part of it. I mean, part of it was just having a drive to say, like, if you're going to do the thing, then it's going to take a lot of work, but let's just make stuff. The other side of it is like, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think people really want to take a chance on stuff. I think people really, in fact, like the older I get and the more people get paid around me and the more I have opportunities to be paid for directing, it only makes me want to do this kind of filmmaking more and figure out a way to maybe, hopefully, one day get paid for that. But that's sort of not the point. Like, I think we, when you start taking paid jobs, you wind up compromising your art a little bit, right? You wind up having to answer to others, and you don't get to make that pure thing that you all on set or you all in the writer's room want to make. And so I think that that's, there's like a sanctuary in kind of like that collective filmmaking, because you know that you're all just answering to yourselves, you know, and nobody else has like an investment or is kind of leveraging you one way or another for a brand or for a look or we don't do this or that's too weird or whatever it is. If you're just making a film with a bunch of people not getting paid who just want to make a film with you, you get really weird because why right. wouldn't you?
Yeah. I mean, I think the trick is, how do you make the turn? How do you make the turn into being able to have that kind of, you know, I think that you just framed it as a compromise when it comes to getting paid for it. But you're almost looking, you're looking for the opportunity to get paid and not have to in that phrase, compromise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that just means to have the same type of creative freedom that something with no stakes has. I don't know if that's possible.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, I mean, something about the no stakes environment or that environment that's like, there ain't nothing else in it for us, y'all, except for this and for this experience and for this growth creatively and this expression. And you kind of can't replace that with money. Once money gets involved, it becomes a thing that is like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, unless you shoot for the one star you actually want to hit, which is that you make something that is so clear and unique and specific that people want to pay you to make that.
Sure.
Don't you think that it's those very hard, yeah, hard to get there.
And don't those people still have to answer for it? It's like, I'm trying to think of who's a good example of like somebody like that. Like, I guess like maybe I think about like, you talk about indie people like Linklater, right?
Uh-huh.
That guy answers to not really anybody.
Sure.
In some ways. But doesn't he still has to deliver. And all it takes is one thing that goes wrong or a couple things in a row that go wrong. And it starts to fall apart, the opportunity to keep doing the thing. And then so you sort of can't, even in that circumstance, you're free, but you're not.
Mm-hmm.
You still are thinking about the investors or the companies that are investing or the studio that you're involved with, the people that are giving you the leash and saying, I still got to give them something back.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I think that it's you're never going to be as free as you are in those situations we were talking about a few minutes ago. However, the stakes and the restrictions, even in having people investing or having a budget or all of that, forces you into a creativity that isn't necessarily there in those other situations.
Okay.
But that's not to say that you still have stakes and, you know, I mean, the fact that people aren't getting paid on your set and you guys are going to just do it by shoestring and everybody's got to work on Monday morning are also stakes, just a different kind of stakes.
Yeah.
So, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, it's interesting to think. I was reading an AV Club article earlier in the week. I don't know if you saw that, was talking about how Netflix keeps like Netflix is now like Galactus devourer of worlds.
Yeah.
And so like all of these films that were standout films on Sundance, Netflix has already bought and has already released on Netflix, and nobody will ever watch them. They'll never get a theatrical release, and they're kind of buried in this pile of films, and it's like they're not shiny anymore. They're not interesting. And there's a film by Adam Leon, his second film, that got bought, and they're saying, like, not – he made this film, right? He's the director of this film, but when the film was sold to Netflix – he had nothing to do with that, right? Because he didn't invest his money in it. So the people who actually get to sell the film are not him, right? He was hired on to be the directorial vision. And so this film gets sold without him. Then he finds out after the fact that his film just got sold.
Yeah.
It's going to get buried in Netflix. And his response was like, I feel really good because I know that I'm going to pay back all my investors. Everybody who worked on the film will get paid properly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good day. And so it's like, where do you sit?
Yeah.
Because meanwhile... I was talking to a good friend of mine at Animal Kingdom Films, and he was saying that places like CineReach, it seems like the films that they're supporting, they want to make sure get theatrical release.
Yeah.
That's crucial.
Sure.
Which I feel like it is as well, because now I'm looking at like something that I can watch on Netflix tonight, and for whatever reason, I'm less excited about it. And that's a quality film. Or I can't find it.
Right.
So I don't know. Like, I think, I mean, this is me kind of like going down a rabbit hole, but I guess it's sort of like what is satisfaction? And so dependent on your stakes, right? If the stakes are, hey, buddies, like, let's all come out of our house today and I'm going to use my, you know, parents', you know, old camera and we're going to make a film this weekend and hopefully we can get into a film festival. When you get into like a bottom tier or mid tier film festival with that film that you made for no money, that's probably like the ultimate. Right?
Yeah.
That's the ultimate goal with that film.
Yeah.
And so when you're then working in a multi-million dollar or even like $1 to $2 million indie feature and you make it and you're proud of it and somebody buys it for twice the amount it costs to make,
sure.
That is a win as well, right? So it sort of depends upon at what level you're playing and satisfaction really changes in that way.
And it's also a matter of like we're living in the medium of film in this way. This type of expression is somewhere in between art and commerce.
Well, that's film in general.
Yes, and it has to be because it's not like personally, like I feel like there is a route for other types of art, like even visual art, right? That can be just for the sake of artistic expression because it's you and it's materials and it's something that can be expressed. And sure, you can also think of it as something you need to sell or want to sell or can sustain yourself on. But it is something that's like, because it's so it's exclusive to self and it's your creation, that it can, if you choose, live as just pure artistic expression. Maybe somebody out there would disagree with that. But film as a collaborative medium never can be, because you're balancing in the moment where you're saying artistic, it's just us, buddies. It's just us getting out of our house to do this thing. Shit, man, it's not just me anymore. I can't make the movie by myself. Not in that scope.
Sure.
Not in that
way. Yeah, I mean, in that way that it's like a team sport, absolutely.
And I'm responsible to those people's wants and needs and creative hopes, too. I can disregard it.
Yeah, especially if you're a creative lead.
Yeah,
if you're a producer, if you're a director, right? If you're the people who are saying this is worth being a part of, then you feel a responsibility to making them feel that way at the other end of it,
exactly.
Right? Whether that means a festival or just watching the film later and feeling something.
Yeah.
I think the other thing, and I don't know how much we want to go down like a filmic, you know, tunnel here, but at the base level, filmmaking, right? Film gets invented by two different people at the same time and they both are, or well, three, but in two different places at the same time and they're both like, I did it. No, I did it. So, right, it's the Lumiere brothers in Paris or in France, and it's Edison. Edison says, I created a film camera. It's gigantic. I built a house around it, and I'm going to bring all the best performers to perform in front of it. So here's a belly dancer. Here's a magician. Here's a ballerina. The Lumiere brothers say, we create a camera. It's small. It's portable. I'm going to go out, and I'm going to document everything that's happening in France right now in time.
Yeah.
And I'm going to show you what it is to wash things. I'm going to show you what it is to build roads. I'm going to show you all this stuff. We need to capture what the reality of right now is. Those are the film is still exactly that way, right? It's narrative and entertainment, and it's documentary and exploring real life.
Sure.
And it continues to be that. But the one thing that's true of both of those folks, right, is that they're creating something, and they have to consider their audience in such a deep way that in some ways with other art types, you don't have to consider your audience. And you certainly don't have to consider an audience of 60, 100, whatever people all sitting together looking at the same time. And emotionally, even though they're not looking at each other, connecting to each other and laughing and crying together. And so one of the things that I noticed with young filmmakers is that they forget their audience. And you're making a medium, and you can't, you're right, you can't make a film alone for yourself, because when you're making a film, you're making it to show it to others.
Yeah.
And you're fooling yourself if you don't think that's part of it. And so at that point, you have to think, what do you want the others to feel? And that's why if you want to make a NBC hit show, then you know what you want them to feel. Sure. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's a great thing to do. People love that. Most people love that,
yeah.
Right? And if you want to make a film that takes a social issue or an unheard voice and gives it an opportunity to be out there on film in a way that wasn't allowed to over the course of history, again, you're doing something really important, but part of it is trying to share that with many people, right?
Yeah.
It's all – the audience is such an integral player in filmmaking in a way that it's not quite that, it seems, in almost every other medium.
Sure.
And so, and part of that is that entertainment's part of this thing.
Yeah.
It's entertainment at Jump Street. So.
100%, man. I don't think that's a rabbit hole. I think that that's what we're, that's
we can
what we're
talk
here to
about
fucking
that?
Talk
we can
about.
Talk, okay, cool.
That's
cool,
what
cool.
we're here to talk
just
about.
Just making sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think that part of the reason that I'm curious to talk to you about that experience is because it also feels like you're, when we last talked, it felt like you were with this creative culture project at the Burns starting to pivot a little bit in terms of you've been part of these groups. You've seen the process as a you know, an equal and as somebody who has like a want going into it and has played different creative roles in the process across a lot of different mediums. And now in this position you're in at the Burns now, it feels like you're sort of like pivoting into a little bit more of a mentor as well as a collaborator. Because I saw your, when I came to the screening, your name was all over the credits and all these different ways. So I'm like, oh yeah, Sean's got his elbows dirty in
no,
this
wasn't,
stuff, man.
No, wasn't my choice. They're very, very kind makers.
Yes, but I just mean, but it feels like in the position you're in now, you have the ability to sort of like take some of those lessons that you've learned in the process and try to help, you know what I mean, help foster new voices and new filmmakers as well. So I'm curious to sort of see what that pivot is feeling like or looking like for you and what the sort of goals of this program are. Before we get to that, let's go back to the beginning. How do you get involved in the Burns in the first place? And even what is the Burns for people who don't know?
Sure. I think the quick rundown of what the Jacob Burns Film Center is, it's up in Westchester. It's in Pleasantville, New York. And it is a nonprofit kind of art house theater and education center. And it's a nonprofit that was built off of those two pillars, programming and film and education. The founding executive director, Steve Apcon, kind of came up there, was fascinated by film, and also found folks like Janet Maslin and Ron Howard and Ang Lee and all these sort of incredible names of film who have one way or another made their way out of the city, but would have loved to have a film forum right down the street. And so right. kind of the Burns kind of takes hold in that sense. But more importantly, they would love to see that the ideas and ideals of visual storytelling and how we can become better at communicating with one another globally if we do so through images is something that we need to invest in as well. So the Burns kind of functions as a place where you can see all of the great art films and global films and docs. And, you know, I mean, we're showing colossal and like pretty big films as well.
Sure.
And retrospective stuff, but also a place where people are working classes to learn how to make films, learn that and sort of address issues that they feel like need addressing through film.
Yeah.
So that's what the Burns is. The way I came about it, I was at SUNY Purchase. When I graduated, I worked at like a news station and was quickly replaced by two interns. They're like, we're going to just have these interns do your job and now you're screwed.
Sure.
And I managed to just get a job with them as a manager of the theater. And then over the course of many years, now 11 or 12 years, they have grown and expanded so much. And I just spent the bulk of my time there as a faculty member, teaching there and teaching at SUNY Purchase and working largely with teens as well as in kind of outreach programs like at the local prison. I did projects in there with incarcerated youth and just kind of like figured out, you know, that it's not that there's a way to teach film to everybody that's valuable. And then there are those folks who are going to kind of shoot above that and want to keep following that path further. Yeah. So the majority of my time at the Burns really up until recently has been that first step, which is that everybody can really gain something by thinking about how to communicate things through film.
Yeah.
And now we're sort of like jumping over that line, which is from like educational or to professional.
Sure.
And so that's kind of what creative culture is.
And that's a new type of initiative that's happening there?
Yeah. So what happened, I mean, in the same way that We Are Strangers, that feature that Private Cabin made, a lot of folks at the Burns who were working there, one of the perks was that they could use these kind of great cameras and when they weren't being used by students.
Sure.
And so people who were there started making festival-ready work and getting awarded and all this stuff. And eventually you have to kind of like look at what's happening at the place versus like the stuff that's happening kind of below the table. And and what was happening below the table was great. You know, people were making real work and professional work. So we had a fellowship for a number of semesters that was restricted to folks under 30 in the Hudson Valley area. And at the end of, I was a mentor of that fellowship. And at the end of every time, they would love their experience. They'd generate short films. But at the end, they said it would be really cool if there were other people working on something like me, because it would have been nice to have a community.
Sure.
And so that gave us this idea that we should create an initiative that allows there to be as many as we can short films being produced here at a professional level, curated, right? Things that are applied for that we think fit our programmatic mission and that these makers are actually capable of accomplishing, right? Not that they're saying, I want to make this feature, and we're like, go for it. And they're like, I've never used a camera.
Sure.
So we're bringing in the right projects and then letting them kind of work together in what feels like a senior thesis experience. Because when you think about the end of most film schools or college experiences, you have that like last two semesters where suddenly everybody in your class who is figuring shit out for a number of years are all good at doing their thing. And when they are, you're ready to kind of all operate at the highest level and all kind of help each other get even better. And in college, you get that for about 6 months. And then, you know, the bottom drops out and you leave and you wind up in the world and you're back home or wherever.
Yeah.
And you can't find a community like that ever again. Or maybe you do if you're one of the lucky ones.
Sure.
So how could we provide like more of that indefinite senior thesis experience? And that's really where creative culture kind of began to be built out of.
Yeah, and you're headed into the sort of second cycle of it now.
Yeah, yeah. So we spent this year doing a full pilot. What was nice is that we brought back all those people who said, I wish I had a community. That was our pilot class. So back like 2.5 years and we said, everybody come back, make a short film. You all know that we're experimenting and figuring this thing out.
Sure.
We also brought in a guy who's working in virtual reality because we knew that we want to expand to be able to support that. But part of being a guinea pig is figuring out, can we?
Yeah.
And does somebody working in VR fit within a group of filmmakers? Is story and the idea of telling a story through screen enough there? Or is VR so different that those folks don't mesh?
Yes.
Our experience was that it worked great. You know, we focused largely on story, but it worked really well. And so we had them all make films over the course of about 5 or 6 months and then just recently premiered those. Now, between now and the end of June, are working to hustle those films.
Sure.
So getting them out there, getting them into festivals, and also beginning development of their next projects and talking about fundraising, grant writing, and all of that.
So in terms of like that group of people specifically, because those films exist and people can see information about like what they are online. So like they've come to fruition. Mm-hmm. In terms of like what you guys were looking for in makers to incubate this program the first time around, other than the ones who are saying, I want to do more here, I want something more, what about their sort of like, you know, skill level or interest or passion, or like what about their ability to be makers were you looking for in like finding people who were right for what became kind of like a community?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a few things. I mean, I think this is a point where my experiences before really lead up to helping me make those selections with a group. And honestly, UCB becomes a really good example of a place where In good ways and bad ways, I was informed of how to approach a new community like this, and that's not, I mean, it's invaluable, my experience here.
Sure.
And so in that way, that like this is where like the notion of socialism started to like retract a little or retreat a little
yeah.
for what I wanted to build up there, particularly because with a program like Digital that was wonderful and did kind of like. Give everybody this great opportunity to work together as a group. There was something about when you put that many people in a group, all as direct peers, that I think kind of leveraged each other all towards the middle a little. And it was hard to let one of those people who had a wild idea that could be wildly original and nobody could even imagine what wonderful thing lied around that corner.
Sure.
You couldn't let somebody run that far because eventually just, you know, somebody would pull that person back. And it wasn't out of any malintention. It was because that's just how creatively, like, people are different, right? And so,
sure.
So how could we bring in folks that had unique enough creative voices and kind of let them reach their full potential and also take those creative risks within this community?
Yeah.
And so part of it was that we weren't going to have these eight people work together on a single project. We were going to bring in eight people to Creative Culture, and we were going to have them work on their different projects, and we'd have to curate a group of people who were not overlapping in the type of project that they were making, because we weren't looking to create a competitive environment. We're trying to create a collaborative environment,
yeah.
which is where the other stuff, all the values that are everywhere you look at UCB, really come into play. I mean, we very much take that idea of pure collaboration, of raising all ships, right? Of listening and making sure that the other person's better than, you know, lift them up. Don't worry about where you're at, and they'll lift you up as well. We took those values and put it in. And so the idea was that you all are making different projects. You're working in stop motion animation. You're working in VR. You're working in documentary. You're working in traditional narrative, right?
Right.
So in no way do you guys feel like you're kind of butting heads or making the same thing. And by having that distinct different of creative projects at play, then the ability to have them really support each other and give to each other was easy
yeah.
because nobody felt kind of like encroached on their creative vision. They just realized that if they kind of created a pretty an extremely supportive environment, they could all learn something from one another. So one person starts sharing how to mood board and do pre-production. The other
yeah.
person discusses documentary ethics. Another person's talking to us about color grading. I mean, it's like everybody starts to share their superpowers. And by the end of it, everybody's that much better at making their thing because people are being very generous
yeah.
because nobody's feeling threatened.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody felt threatened in Digital. I think that it was just the idea that everybody was a creative lead
sure.
that kind of forced everybody to collaborate but also compromise a little bit.
Yeah, no, and look, we don't need to sit here and say that the Digital program as it's existed at UCB is a perfect structure. We never claimed it to be perfect.
Right,
it
right,
was
right.
always about throwing a lot of shit against the wall and understanding that like by sort of like putting people in a room together and saying, make awesome shit, bye-bye, that's hopefully the best way to challenge people to sort of like have those honest conversations, mm-hmm. give what they can to each other and sort of like take back from each other the best of each other too, but
mm-hmm.
definitely not a perfect system.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting for me to hear your experience there, because it sounds like the one way that could fall apart is if you don't get people in the room who are interested in, who are also sort of like generous or intellectually curious or sort of like passionate outside of what is their thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because you could wind up with people who go, yeah, I'll take the support you're giving me,
mm-hmm.
but I don't want to make a documentary, so who gives a shit?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, in your screening process, too, there must be some element of, like, just looking for that type of maker, too, someone who wants to, who loves making for the sake of making,
yeah.
in a way.
Yeah, I mean, that buy-in's imperative,
yeah.
right? And there's a philosophy, again, you know, call it what you will. I mean, UCB does this really well. We, at this point in time in our human history, love cultish philosophies that make us better, right?
Sure.
And so there is that philosophy that says if you're part of this community, you have to buy into these principles. And Creative Culture kind of puts that forth and says, like,
sure.
this stuff is imperative. It's
yeah.
not an option for you to be generous with what you know. It's not an option for you to want that person's project to be great.
Yeah.
And if that's a problem, like, this is just probably not the community for you, because if one person isn't partaking in it, the House of Cards could fall apart.
Sure.
So part of it is that dual mission of the Burns of saying education and filmmaking. Mm-hmm. And if you value education, and if you understand that teaching somebody is a good way to not only make other people better, but make you reflective and make you better at the thing because you're teaching it and thinking about it from a different angle, you can kind of buy into this community in the right way.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, I mean, that's a big, important, imperative part of it. And what's funny is that that bucks how we have been taught, at least for the majority of our lives, to think about how the film industry should work.
Sure.
It's such a, like, it's me against the world. They like me. They don't like you, man. You're out. You know, like this whole
yeah.
thing. However, what I'm learning with this group, because now we have this group of folks who made these short films, and out of eight of them, three of them are Sundance Fellows, and two of them have Vimeo staff picks in the past couple months, and folks have, like, their studios and production houses that are keeping their eye on them. One of them just got the Emily Ann Hoffman just got the Birth of a Nation Fellowship, where she's going to be able to develop out a feature film
awesome.
With Sundance's
Great.
Feature program.
Yeah.
So why are those eight people who were curated, but were curated and local, and I'm sure there's a lot of other people that are very good out there, why are those eight people like catching fire so quickly out of creative culture? Because that old way that we think about filmmaking is a way that a lot of people want to see change. And so I think that the fact that institutions like Sundance and upstart or really exciting independent production houses, when they look at what we're doing at Creative Culture, they're like, yeah, that's the kind of filmmaker we want to work with.
Sure.
This collective idea of making films is the way that this should move. And these folks are doing a very good job of bringing in people who need to tell important stories,
yeah. like
stories about women, stories about non-white folks, stories that kind of matter. And so in that way, I think that there's a change coming. And so part of it is kind of investing in a better, you know, yeah, better situation
better
for
system.
how the system, right. The system can change.
Yeah, I mean, that's
there's
really
a song
that's,
that
yeah.
probably goes like that.
That's cool. I mean, it also is from the outside looking in, and we talked about this mm-hmm. before, but like my first cult was DCTV
mm-hmm.
downtown. And that's an organization that is a media center and a nonprofit and has programs to develop filmmakers, but like it also never makes like they do it essentially by making films. Like, I don't know if you've seen their new movie, but the John Alpert just made a new movie. John and Matt made this movie that's like called Rock and a Hard Place on HBO. Mm-hmm. It's like The Rock is in it for like 10 minutes
mm-hmm.
and executive produced it. But like, it's fucking awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Like they've used their sort of like very high level, like exposure and like projects to feed a nonprofit system
mm-hmm.
that lets them foster, you know, I think it's like there's a program that's like for what they sort of term at-risk youth. I think mm-hmm. is the way it's described now. There used to be a program that was about filmmakers with disabilities. It's like about empowering voices and offering people like practical documentary type skills. But the organization is still so ground level.
Mm-hmm.
It's still like there's what John does. And then there's what the community does. And there hasn't been like a lot of people to sort of like bridge the gap. And that being said, they do amazing work, and I fucking love that place and
mm-hmm.
will forever.
Mm-hmm.
But I just mean what it sounds like you guys are bridging in this type of environment is you're still like you've still got a lot of like high level people who love the Burns and do sort of like the sort of like glitzy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the movie theater that's sort of like an engine,
mm-hmm.
and you've got the classes that sort of offer stuff. And now in the middle there, you're also like finding a way to be like, we're a place that also helps launch filmmakers.
Right.
Which is great for the whole thing. That's
right.
An amazing sort of like scope of experience that you can come to that place and take a class and go see a movie and be inspired and find your peers and shit, they'll help you get your career going too, and then you can come back at the end and be at the gala.
Exactly.
Right?
That's the plan. That's the dream.
Hey, that's great.
I mean,
man.
The real dream is that we help seed a film that then goes off, wins awards, and when it opens in New York and LA, it also opens at the Burns.
Yeah.
And we can announce it and say, we're so happy to have this film here.
Yeah.
It started here.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. It's, you know, here's the thing, like, it seems like, and I'm not an expert in it, but it seems like these different nonprofits, you look and reflect on what's working for them, where it, what is their strength. So at the Burns, certainly a strength is that we have a wildly popular, incredibly well-programmed five cinema theater that has a strong membership.
Yeah.
So that base is going to, like you said, be an engine to run an organization and allow you, afford you the opportunity to do some of your other mission stuff to help cultivate important, unheard, young, but not just young, of any age filmmakers.
Yeah.
And so, so yeah, how do you sort of think about where you want, what you want to be doing, right, with that kind of like extra area? And for us, the idea of something like creative culture was feeds the system in the best way, right? Because if what's important for us is to put films on screen like Moonlight or like Kelly Reichardt's films or Eliza Hittman's films, right? If that's really important to us, then one of the best things we could do is try to give that first leg up to the next version of some of those filmmakers and take bets on those filmmakers and kind of and help them figure out their professional voice, their creative voice, and see if we can use our network to say, hey, this person's shiny. This person's great. You should take a look. Yeah. And so far it's working out. But part of that is that you have a brand in the Burns that is well-respected within that community.
Sure.
We're starting to encroach in a new area of the industry, but there's already some trust because they've done so well to appeal to that industry with their educational efforts and screening important work.
Yeah.
So.
And in terms of like where that leaves like you, both in inside of this program and sort of like extracurricularly, professionally.
Mm.
Like it seems like this has also become something that's like you're clearly passionate about this program and about this aspect of your life and your job and your career. Where do you continue to develop, Sean, the creative and the director at this point? You said you have a film that's headed for festivals.
Yeah. So
how else do you feed that side?
Yeah, I spent honestly, the film that's going to festivals, we shot right when digital began. So that's years ago now. And then that kept us pretty busy. And then this came up and just things pushed it back.
Sure.
The a short documentary that I'm putting into festivals right now, similarly, was something I'd made 2-3 years ago that just I never had the time to put out there. So the reality is that there's not enough time and that I'm very passionate about creative culture. And you start to grow and realize how good you are at things that you might not have known you were good at. And that forces you to look in the mirror and say, you know, to Sean, the director, yeah, seems like there's something there. I still believe in you, Sean, the director, but Sean, the creative producer's kind of doing well right out the gate. So maybe Sean, the creative producer should like stick around. And so this is like, you know, I mean, everybody has these moments where you grow up and you sort of have to like think about what you're really good at.
Yeah.
Now, that's not me trying to shit on Sean, the director. And actually, the fact that right now we're hustling these films from creative culture into festivals has given me an opportunity to hustle my work into festivals as well. Because if I'm doing that parallel with these makers, I'm learning a lot, and I'm both the guinea pig and the kind of leader of the community, and that's great.
Yeah.
So what does that mean looking forward? Well, honestly, by working with these folks and by getting to understand by way of going to festivals, talking to curators and other people in the industry, I feel like I have a much better understanding of how to position yourself if you're a filmmaker to get yourself out there, get your work into festivals, and get your work seen. And some of that stuff's objective, but when you're on the outside and it's a black box, you're like, I don't know how I'm supposed to get in there.
Sure.
Right? So, like, one of those things that's, like, pretty simple and obvious is that, or should have been, but I wouldn't have thought about, is, like, you should make a really good 5-minute film, period. Do not make a 15-minute film. A lot of our fellows sort of came back from their festivals and said, listen, the programmers say, if you show me a good 5-minute film or you submit to me a good 15-minute film, short, for my festival, I have to say no to two extra slots to let your 15-minute film in.
Sure.
But if you're a good 5-minute film, I can put it all over the place. Because it'll fit my program. And I don't have to, like, screen less artists. And if I'm showcasing short work, I want to screen a bunch of folks. So give me the opportunity to show other people's work. And if your work's good, it'll be amongst that group.
Yeah.
So then when you're thinking about that and you're like, oh, all I have to do is make a good, important 5-minute film, then you have to think about, like, what is important? What is a story worth telling? I've spent a lot of time in my life as, like, a multiracial person telling stories about white guy existential crisis,
sure.
You know, which is an important story, but was kind of more an important story in, like, the Eternal Sunshine, Garden State era. And now a lot of people have experienced that story. So, like, how do you reflect on, if you have the choice to tell a story, what's a story that doesn't maybe feel already told?
Yeah.
And how can you tell a story that might feel new or give, again, somebody else who doesn't get to be shown on film historically for whatever fucked up reason, the opportunity to have a film, right?
Yeah.
And so how do you kind of think about telling a story? It's not saying that your work has to be a social action piece, but you can make choices that create a film that feels really unique, because right now we're seeing, like, film after film after film that's like, whoa, I haven't seen that before. That's incredible. And the reason was like racism, you know, or all these things for the history of this industry that did not allow those stories to be told.
Sure.
And we're right now in a moment where everybody's like, no, no, tell all the stories. And there's so many out there. And so.
And the technology's helped to crack it open, too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, like, so think about it. If you're going to spend a lot of time making and telling a story, maybe don't tell a white guy existential story, you know?
Yeah.
And that's not saying, like, don't base that, but base from truth. And that isn't saying that we can't have a white guy protagonist.
Yeah.
It's just saying, like, think about when you're telling a story, right, you're basing it on, it's like the devil's in the detail and the universal experience, right? Tell a story that everybody, that your audiences can connect to, whether they're in Guam or wherever, right? And then make sure that the place that story is taking place in and the people are, the details are really well realized.
Yeah.
They're specific, right?
Yeah.
So it's operating on both sides. It's an even balance. There's loads of places that haven't had their stories told.
Yeah.
But chances are a lot of early filmmakers go out there and tell the story in anywhere America or suburban America and sacrifice those details that are probably the texture that would have made your film stand out in the first place.
Sure.
Because you'd be like, that is Cranston, Rhode Island. That's their accent. People drink, you know, Dell's lemonade and eat New York System hot wieners, and that's what they do on a Friday night. That's a good movie. But, like, that is suburbia and people are drinking an unnamed beer is a little less specific and winds up being a less, in some ways, a less interesting film.
Yeah.
So, like, how do you kind of dig into something deep enough? And if, again, like, I'm rambling, but if you do that, you can easily do that for 5 minutes. You know, you can make a film that's that specific for 5 minutes and not spend a lot of money and put a film out there that has weight to it and is really well realized,
yeah.
And it's easier on the festival programmer to put it in.
Yeah.
So.
And are you, you're sort of like, that's advice that you're offering, but that's also advice that you're sort of like thinking about for you as a creative going forward too.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. It's like, it's inspiring to work with young filmmakers. It's inspiring to work with folks who are working in all different ways.
Sure.
And it forces you to kind of look in the mirror and be like, well, if they all have that specific thing, and if they're kind of going down those paths and taking creative risks, what the hell am I doing?
Yeah.
So what is the thing that I have brought to the table that is my approach or, you know, your quote-unquote artistic voice? So it's forced me to look back a lot of my work and think about as objectively as one can be, like, what is the strength?
Yeah.
And honestly, that moment with that first feature, We Are Strangers, where we all sat around a table and shared what it would be like if a guy that we hadn't seen in 20 years from high school showed up at our door and forced us to, like, unpack all of that stuff from high school and connect with what it is to, like, have to be friends and bring up all this stuff. And when we all gave our real stories and put that into a pot and then performed, created beats, and then performed that very story that we had that was a kind of like a collage of all of our real experiences, that's the best acting. And that's how we did our second feature as well, Private Cabin. That's the best acting that I've ever had in a film. That's the best, some of the best cinematography and pacing that I've ever had in the film. It didn't have a script per se.
Sure.
And most importantly, those are the films that I've shown to people that when we leave the theater, the people who come up to me don't talk to me about the film, but talk to me about somebody who the film reminded them of, or a moment in their life that was just like that moment in your film. Mm. And if that isn't your goal at making a film, like, I don't know what is, right? That somebody was so emotionally invested in the story that you're giving them that forced them to reflect on their life and their experience.
Yeah.
And so to me, looking back now, I'm trying to grab that thing and say, hey, if that's my voice, even if, like, it's not about getting paid or gang work out there, it's if I can grab that thing and continue to do that, that feels like a good use of time. Still being aware of my audience.
Sure.
But maybe I'm being aware of my audience on a more personal level. I don't know.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, and it's all a process.
And it sounds like it's interesting because sometimes being aware of your audience feels like it's, like, I think especially in a YouTube, and now even that's an old reference, in a Snapchat age, it's sometimes being aware of your audience means to people being aware of metrics, being mm-hmm. aware of analytics, being aware of engagement. Can I get them to turn off the sound? It's so much of a thought process in the digital sort of like content creation sure. mindset. You're not talking about the kind of products, the kind of film products that are experienced in that way.
No, I mean, that makes me think of, not to be the most pretentious film watcher, but in Pierre Le Fou, right, Jean-Luc Godard's film, which is sort of like an out there, incredible film.
Why would you think that would make you sound pretentious?
Oh, why? Why would referencing a French New Wave film make
why
me sound like a complete
like
dick?
No.
But in that film, there's this great moment where Anna Karenina and Jean Belmondo are in a car and they turn on the radio. And on the radio, they say, like, something, I'm sure this is the quote's wrong, but something like, 16 people died today in a bomb explosion in Algeria. In other news, da-da-da-da-da-da. And they go on this, like, very French New Wave, like, 16 people, like, 16, that's a number. Those are people. They lived lives, right? And
yeah,
kind of like,
yeah.
How can you reduce them to just a number? But what you're saying about kind of the value upon clicks and hits and metrics is exactly that argument to me. It's like, if you can be concerned with your audience by way of how many people paid blank amount of money, these numbers, or how many people clicked or watched for this many seconds, whatever, all those metrics.
Sure.
But that's not allowing you to do the thing that hopefully, or that some of us are trying to go out there and do, which is trying to think about our audience as humans who we're trying to, like, interact with, right?
Yes.
And so if you're thinking about your audience as metrics, that's one way to kind of be aware of your audience. But if you think about them as, like, folks that you're trying to share something with or make a story for, to let them, you know what I mean, like, that they would be
yeah.
able to receive and emotionally connect to or whatever, that's another way of thinking of your audience. So I think there's, like, different ways to play that idea. But regardless, I mean, in the metrics way, which isn't something I'd want to subscribe to, but I recognize is a valid way to succeed in this business, that's still thinking. I mean, you either way, you got to think about your audience if you're making film.
Sure.
And that's the way that you're going to make money, likely, or more easily.
Yeah, and look.
Oh, I'm not saying that that's what you're saying. I guess what I'm pointing out is, like, the way in which you're thinking about your audience is important as well.
No, absolutely. I'm more saying that I think that there is such a pull. Especially in the, like, and the other thing that I'm noticing in this conversation is you're also talking about the experience of watching something in a theater and the value there. And I'm of the mindset that I don't think the movie theater is ever going to die
mm-hmm.
because I think we crave that communal experience. The question is, what kind of art will be exhibited in that space
mm-hmm.
that takes a brick and mortar space to bring people into? And we see it go further and further towards the spectacle
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the experimental. But I just mean, a lot of people aren't making for that experience. They're making for the digital
mm-hmm.
experience,
mm-hmm.
which is dominated mm-hmm. by those type of conversations. View count, engagement, subscribe, you know what I mean? And there is, again, there's this balance between the art that you're making and the sort of, like, commerce side of it,
mm-hmm.
right? That is, like, just different for everybody to sort of, like, navigate in their career experience. Like, I'm very, like, I'll say it. I'm very jealous of the what appears to be the flexibility that your job offers you, which is to work purely in a space that feels like it's supported artistically and liberated from. It's a nonprofit, for God's sake. It's it is like that is the definition of liberated from commercial bottom line. Like you still have to stay open.
Sure.
But like you're purely liberated. That sounds incredible.
Yeah, and you have to find.
I know it's more nuanced than that too, because I've been on the inside of that, and it's it's not easy.
Right, but I mean, part of the reason why that thing can even exist, or a place like that can exist, is that there are people, there are benefactors or philanthropists, who believe that that's one of the most important things to have in a society, and so they're like, take my money and make sure that that stays around.
And God, I hope it keeps going like that, man. We need that.
But I, and you know, not to get political, though we did start with socialism.
I know.
I have a feeling that we're going to see better and better work, and we're going to see more and more philanthropists in the next 4 years making sure that this thing stays strong.
Oh,
and there is a greater conviction and need and drive behind a lot of creative people right now than there has been during. You know, I'm all for Obama, but during a period of time where I think people felt like they could kind of kick back a little because this thing was on autopilot.
Opposition means collectivizing.
Right.
Like,
yes,
when you feel like you're stacked against it, it makes it easier to coalesce around the values that you feel are important.
Right.
As opposed to when you feel like it's not that they're not under threat.
Right.
It makes it easier to be like, well, they're not under threat.
And the
I don't have to care.
The technology changes. And the technology changes so quickly that we can't keep up with it. So if you say, how long, 3 years ago is when digital started?
About. Yes.
So if 3 years ago that's going on, at that point, we're hearing, I mean, and maybe you're hearing it still because you're closer to it, but you're hearing viral this and viral that. And now viral seems like a passe term because it's not, things don't function, viral doesn't function in that way. There isn't 1 to 5 videos that flame up on the internet and it's like everybody's seen them because the internet and the way in which videos are consumed has shifted.
Sure.
So what is the digital version of those kind of like art house or independent or kind of unheard voices films? It's kind of your Vimeo staff picks.
It is. That's what I was going to say. It's staff pick.
And those
they have staked out that place and it's awesome.
And those films are some of the best films you'll ever see.
Yeah.
I mean, there are films, and if you watch those films and you wait a year to 2 years, you're going to see a feature by some of those filmmakers that'll knock your socks off.
And the thing that I wish is that there was an easier place to do it together.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like, that's the part of it that I'm missing from that. And this is not to have to do anything, but...
No.
That's the part that I miss in watching those is I watch those and I'm like, shit, I wish there were people... Like, I wish I was watching it with people.
Would you go to... So if The Burns or IFC Center did a staff picks Friday night?
I like to think that I would.
But you probably wouldn't.
In reality,
if you knew
it
was there on your computer, you might not.
Less that. Like... Especially since becoming a parent, I value the movies. In fact, I was just talking to Haas about I'm contemplating whether tomorrow to go take my daughter to Boss Baby. I've even found a place for like for kids movies, even bad ones.
Yeah.
I'm like, I will go watch that. Of course I will. And I love taking her there and seeing her experience it.
Sure.
And like the movies have become something that I really value in part because I feel a little bit sequestered from it in that in order to do it, I have to separate from my family, and that's something that like doesn't always jive. It doesn't feel right either.
Sure.
So like I value when I get to do it.
Right.
I wish that I like to believe that were it to be a perfect world, I would love to go to that stuff more. And whenever I go to film festivals, the shorts are always what I go to.
Oh yeah.
I never miss the shorts.
Yeah.
I'll miss some great features.
Because you're going to see it next week anyways.
Yeah, exactly.
You might never see those shorts.
Exactly.
Because they don't all get Vimeo. I mean, this is what's sort of interesting is like, if you get a staff pick, you're like, cool, this has been curated by folks at Vimeo who are good at curating things. They're great at it. But there's other things that they say no to because they have to, because there's that much content being created right now that's good.
Yeah.
Again, to get like super pretentious, which is now like, I feel like not enough people know me in this community. So after this interview, they're going to be like, well, that guy. But you get to a place where it's like the critic and the curator are extremely important.
Yeah.
So it's like Clement Greenberg and Jackson Pollock. It's like Pitchfork, you know, however many years ago. Like, you're looking for somebody else to say, not just your friend, but somebody whose job it is to say, that's really good and hip.
Yeah.
You should like that. And we desire that. It's kind of the only way that sometimes we kind of can pick something out of the pack.
Yeah.
And that's what Vimeo Staffpick is giving us.
Yeah, absolutely. You know?
And again, they do a good job, but it we are asking for a middle person to kind of dub something better or must see.
Sure. And I think this dovetails nicely
Ooh.
Into what should be a Vimeo staff pick, you know, my opinion, in a new short that you have that's about ready to come out as part of the Trolls series that Brinkman made, the sort of final Brinkman series, which is a collection of short films.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you guys made some really awesome content. The four things that you guys made are some of my favorite stuff that's come out of, you know, the digital program here, period. And you know that.
Yeah, thank you so much. No, it's some of the best friends and some of the best creative experiences. So, yeah, honestly, if at the beginning of this I was talking about how we maybe kind of made each other compromise, I'm not saying that that brought us to a low level. I'm just saying that that brought us to a place where we all had to agree on a creative vision, which theoretically or conceptually means that everybody has to, like, make a sacrifice to a certain extent.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, if you look at the work that Brinkman made, I think all of us are so extremely proud of that work, and that work is still at a very high level.
Absolutely.
So yeah, thank you.
And I think that I always got that impression. I mean, even from day one when we came into the room with you guys in the first meeting, it felt like you were sort of like pushing each other creatively in all the right ways.
Mm.
It helps that you have a lot of strong opinions, but also a lot of people who like debate,
mm-hmm.
is how it felt.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, to some, like, because I like, look, I love Jason Shapiro.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like Shebs, to some people, could be a voice that feels like, God, that guy's really a loud voice here, and it's not somebody who I necessarily want to challenge.
Mm.
But you guys didn't.
All I want to do is challenge Jason Shapiro.
And he doesn't fucking care. He will listen to
it.
He will learn from it.
Yeah.
He will take it. Like, he's great at taking notes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, he's not precious about that shit.
No.
He's a pro.
Yeah, and he wants it.
Yeah.
He wants it bad. Everybody in that room wanted it bad.
In different ways.
Yeah.
They all want it. Mary Lourdes is like that, too.
Oh,
Mary's fucking great.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like, no, it's phenomenal.
Yeah.
And you kind of, like, you push each other in the same way that you might find common middle ground. Sometimes you also push so hard against each other that you wind up in a new creative place that you couldn't have gotten to without that debate.
Yeah.
So, it's a really
But it seems like over time you guys also sort of sought, like, in the first thing you guys did, it was very collaborative. There were no real edges towards, like, who was doing what. You and Dennis co-directed the whole thing, and it was hard to sort of, like, differentiate between who'd written what, and the process seemed very socialist.
Mm-hmm.
This last series, which is about as, like, series is a loose term. I know you guys even threw around the idea of just having it be short films that didn't have a connective tissue.
Mm-hmm.
It's an anthology short film series,
mm-hmm.
But everyone feels distinct and also had very delineated responsibilities,
mm-hmm.
In part because people were, like, moving.
Across the country. No, but I mean, so it was honestly our first time,
yeah.
It was our first time that, so on a lot of the digital teams, you had multiple directors.
Yeah.
It was the first time that Dennis and I split the directing task. Up until that point, we were always co-directors, which meant one of us was holding the camera,
mm-hmm.
but we were both directing.
Mm-hmm.
That's not going to always work. On set, we were called Mom and Dad. I got to be Mom. And that's all good. That's what I'd want to be in that situation. and we had a way and a dynamic that worked. And that might not have happened. I mean, that's a little bit of a crapshoot on you guys putting together a team and hoping that folks find that. This, I think the reason why in Trolls we wound up delineating was less out of growth necessarily, but more in terms of, like, when you create something like digital, which is not a safe space, but a community where you're supposed to be experimenting and growing, right? And using this kind of opportunity to try new things and grow. And if we were going to make the most use out of that experiment, it made sense to try something different than to repeat the same.
Sure.
And so I think that's why we always move to make a short series, and then we made what you said, Life Support, which is pretty much – well, we made Last Two People, which is also like a kind of a more – a longer scoped series. And then we made a feature that was just divided into seven pieces like Life Support. And then after that, it was like, okay, well, we got to try something different. We've already made a feature and a bunch of series. Like, what is different? And it was – let's make a series of short films.
Yeah.
And let's give the writers also an opportunity to say, this is Chet's script, this is Laura's script, this is, you know. And mm-hmm. and so it became this interesting pairing where the director was working directly with that writer. And we all worked together and workshopped it together, but at the end of the day, it was a more traditional hierarchy on set.
Yeah. And the one that's about to come out as this podcast releases is... you know, talk about an existential crisis plotline of white people. That is sort of this one, right?
Yeah. So it's
the second Mrs. Pell.
Yeah, the second Mrs. Pell. So
Vimeo,
this...
if you're listening, staff pick is available.
So just like forewarning, every time the UCB comedy logo comes up at the end of a Brinkman short, it's always the first joke that you've experienced the whole time because we're dark and we're and a lot of the comedy is in the situation or the circumstance rather than in the joke or and certainly often not in the levity of the
sure.
situations. So we get awkward and dark in that way. And this one is Chet wrote it and stars in it, and she plays a young wife who has just married her boss, and she is now a young wife in Long Island, kind of trapped in this suburb. Her now husband's ex-wife recently passed away from breast cancer. Again, jokes, right, with Brinkman. And she's trying to find a way to connect with her new stepson, who's like a kind of awful 13-year-old boy. And so she spends her day vaping in the garage where nobody can see her and getting stoned and doing guided meditations and yoga and just trying to find herself because
yeah.
she's very lost and she's trapped in this kind of like glass modern house.
This is all classic comedy stuff.
Classic comedy. And it plays with wonderful themes like hate speech and domestic abuse.
But here's the comedy element of it, folks. This was made at a time when because this the Trolls series, the idea is that each one of these short films is connected because the main character is a troll of some kind on the internet.
Right.
And you're sort of like personifying what some sort of troll's life looks like.
Right.
And in this one, you decided to troll on Periscope.
Yeah. Does that exist
that's
anymore?
That's the funny part.
Does that exist?
It was made in that moment where it was like, Periscope is definitely going to be the thing. That's the thing. Twitter bought it. It's going to be the big hit.
Is it gone?
I mean, I think that they're actually trying to revamp it. The part
okay.
of it that they, like,
it's not like we did it on Vine, which is actually
which
gone.
Which is actually gone. But,
yeah.
I mean, live stream
well, so
and
here,
commenting
right.
is all the, you know, I mean, it's all six and one half
sure.
dozen, but like.
Sure. No, absolutely. hindsight's 2020. But to our plus, we now cannot avoid thinking about a troll every fucking waking moment of our life because we just elected one president.
Sure.
So in some ways, we did a really good thing by waiting, and in other ways, the technology moved on.
It's just, but isn't that funny? It's like it yeah. hasn't been that long.
No, it's been months.
Since you guys shot it.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh.
Yeah, that's okay. gone now. So but, yeah, so it's a, I mean, it's you know, it's a really interesting film, and Chet's phenomenal in it.
She's great.
I mean, it's like
great.
A really...
It's beautiful.
Yeah, I think you guys will really enjoy it. If this is... Are we selling it? Are we selling it to this, the people who are listening to this?
To the people listening.
Guys,
to,
you should watch
to Vimeo, to everybody. We're
hey,
selling it.
Do me a favor. Watch it.
Good. See, art and commerce coming together, Sean. Art and commerce. Speaking of which, you enjoying your Bronx Rye?
Oh, my God. My New York City Bronx Rye, Bronx Brewery Ale is delicious.
You know, I haven't had one of these since the last DCM.
Was it cool and refreshing when you had it?
At the last DCM, like, it's high alcohol volume.
Mm.
So it's like, it's definitely like good. Like, it's a sipping beer,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Well, thanks for taking time to do this. In
thanks
terms
for having
of,
me.
Of anybody being interested in creative culture and that program and getting involved, where can they go to sort of like see it or maybe even apply for it in that way?
Yeah. So if you go to burnsfilmcenter.org and you kind of scroll down the page a little bit, you'll see Artist Services Creative Culture. And that will link you to the Maker Experience, which is a way to apply and send in a proposal for a short film that you'd like to make there. There are fellowship experiences for women filmmakers and Hudson Valley filmmakers. So if you fit those criteria, you can get paid to be there. And then there we have residencies where we bring folks in. So the deadline for that is July 1st. And I would love to get as many applications as we can get in there, because that allows us to raise the kind of talent level of the pool and make sure that we're keeping all the places we're sending these folks to real happy.
Awesome. So check that out, y'all, and check out the new short on Vimeo. Sean, thanks for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And that'll do it for episode number 43 of the UCB Digital Podcast. Thanks to Sean for sitting down, taking the time to chat, drink a beer with me, and talk all about socialist filmmaking. Hope you enjoyed it, too. If you're based here in New York or interested at all in the Creative Culture program, we're going to tweet out a link so that you can get the information to apply to that program. Applications are still open, and they're really hoping to get some great folks in the door and help them on their career trajectory. So check it all out. You can follow us on Twitter at UCB Digital. On Facebook, UCB Digital Podcast. We'd love to connect with you. You, the listeners, are who make this show possible and who we do this for. So we hope that you're enjoying the show. We hope you'll connect with us. And if you do like it, go ahead and share the show with a friend. That's the best way to sort of spread this show around and build a community of our own as well. And we hope that you'll do that. You can subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes as well at itunes.com/UCB Comedy. We'd really appreciate that. And as always, you can find new content from UCB Comedy everywhere on the social medias, YouTube and Vimeo. New videos all the time. New videos this week on YouTube from our friends Cardinal Goose. They've got a brand new web series. It's a horror anthology sketch series called The Drawings Man Presents. We're really excited about that. We got a new episode coming out this week and for the rest of May, as well as Sean's new movie, The Second Mrs. Pell, which comes out on our Vimeo channel, Vimeo/UCB Comedy, on Thursday, May the 11th. So check that out as well. And thanks to the Bronx Brewery, the official house beer of the UCB Comedy Podcast Network. Visit thebronxbrewery.com to check out all their selection of craft beer brews. I'm going to go over Bronx right now, y'all, so I hope that you have a great week. And until next time, we'll see you on the internet.
This has been a UCB Comedy production. Check out our other shows on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network.